whoever, you know, let him not see it as having only made him happy. This is important. That obviously, that believer is attached to the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. So when you make a believer happy, there is another consequence that comes to it. There's another, you know, group of individuals who become happy. Because you are making a follower of somebody else happy. So the Imam says that when one of you brings joy to another believer, let him not see it as only having made that person happy. Rather, by Allah, the Imam swears by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he makes us happy. That is the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. So we, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, become happy when a believer is made happy by one of our followers. One of our followers is made happy by one of our followers. It shows that there is a connection between the followers and the Imams alayhim salam like this connection. They are happy at this connection between the adherents of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. And then the Imam continues and said, not only are we the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam pleased and happy or gain happiness by this act of yours, by Allah, he makes the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam happy too. That by you making a believer happy, the Prophet is also happy by this act. Obviously the Prophet having that overriding, overlooking stance over the Imams alayhi salam. So obviously by making a believer happy, you make the Ahlul Bayt happy. By making the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam happy, you make the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam happy and joyful too. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to always make the heart of the Holy Prophet happy with us, insha'Allah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, millions of British people could fall into fuel poverty this year. That means that some would have to cut back on the basics in order to be able to heat their homes. This gas shortage and price rise follow empty pumps at petrol stations, where due to a shortage of truck drivers, Brits have had to wait in long lines to fill up their cars. Even the government has brought the army in to drive trucks to try to fill the supply gap. But all of it seems to be pointing to mismanagement by the government. Stay with us as we take a look at it all on the Spotlight. Let's cross over to London, start off with Amina Taylor. Amina, give us your take. What's going on?
Yeah, this is shaping up to what some commentators are saying is a return to the bad old days. The old phrase, winter of discontent, being thrown around here, because not only did you have those rather unsavory scenes of empty fuel pumps and consumers queuing up to get a little bit of petrol for their cars if there was any to go around, you're also combating and trying to balance that with issues in the breakdown of the fuel supply train. You're also looking at a situation where energy firms, some of the smaller ones who were able to perform and provide a little bit more competition in the market, going bust. So on one hand, you have fuel issues at the pumps, and at the other hand, you're looking at fuel issues for the homes. And as always, you have the most vulnerable consumers having to deal with some very real crisis-making decisions about whether or not they can put food in their bellies, food in the bellies of their children, or perhaps provide fuel for their vehicles to get to work, to get to some crucial jobs, or to heat their homes. So I think many of those who would have listened to the Prime Minister's speech a little bit earlier in the week will be wondering what parallel universe Boris Johnson is living in, when so many of his subjects will be wondering just how they will make it through the winter this month. And unfortunately, I believe this is just the beginning of things to come, and unfortunately not the beginning of the end.
Well, I mean, just staying with you briefly, because the Prime Minister has tried to show a brave face and said that things are getting better. I mean, your assessment of people's reaction on the ground, I mean, do they believe this? Do they believe that things are getting better, or are they feel that it's getting worse?
Well, they don't have to believe if it's getting better or worse. They just have to look at the realities on the ground. And even though one might think that the Conservatives would be a bit further behind in the poll, they're not, which tells its own story. But it's also about when this starts to bite a little bit more, because even if individuals didn't have the major issues with their vehicles, maybe these individuals will not be affected by the rise in domestic fuel prices just yet for their homes. When some of these price caps go and people are renegotiating the cost of energy to their homes, they'll really start to feel that bump. And we're talking about hundreds of pounds for even the most conservative estimate here. So unfortunately, it's not a matter of whether they have an impression of what's going on. The reality will soon come to bite, unfortunately. And it's those lower to middle income families that will feel it the most. £400 is nothing to somebody who's earning a lot of money. But believe me, when you're already counting every penny, this is just enough to push you over the edge.
Thank you so much, Amina Taylor, correspondent in London, for that report. I'd like to welcome, out of London now, author and historian Marcus Papadopoulos. And out of Edinburgh, writer and political analyst John White.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us to start this off with Marcus out of London. All right, Marcus, the government says the fuel price happened because there were not enough drivers to supply the service stations. But did the government not calculate this ahead of time? I mean, why was the situation allowed to reach such a critical point?
Well, I should first of all start by saying that, currently speaking, there is no energy crisis in the UK. Further to that, there is no food crisis either. Recently, I travelled from London to Pembrokeshire, stopping off at numerous places along the way. I saw no signs of an energy crisis. I saw no signs of food shortages in any of the supermarkets which I visited. It is certainly the case that a couple of weeks or so ago, people were stockpiling petrol or diesel, and that did cause a short-term problem. But the people who were stockpiling petrol or diesel did so on account of mainstream media outlets in the UK putting out completely uncorroborated, unsubstantiated stories saying that there will be a petrol crisis in Britain. I would also add as well that it is certainly the case that many of these aspects have been mismanaged by the current government. But then this is a problem that has been plaguing Britain for many years now. So we hear about how there will be in Britain this winter a rise in electricity and a rise in gas. But year in, year out, there is always a rise in energy prices in Britain.
So Marcus, are you saying this has been created? I'm sorry to interrupt you. So are you saying that this has been created by the media? And if so, why?
What I believe is that British mainstream media is depicting something in order to distract the British public from a lot of very serious problems at home. It is certainly the case that the British government has relied too extensively on liquefied natural gas. Also, the British government should have put politics aside and should have sat down with the Russian government and secured an energy deal with Russia, which would have resulted with an uninterrupted flow of Russian natural gas. But alas, the British wanted to put politics first, and as a result, if there is to be a shortage of gas this winter in Britain, that will be the fault of the British state, and the ordinary British man and woman will pay the price. And it goes back to what I said moments ago. There is always a rise in the UK every single year in the price of gas and electricity. Why? Because energy was privatised many years ago in Britain. Why is it that people in Russia do not struggle to pay their gas bills or their electricity bills? Why? Because electricity and gas has been state-run. It is not, electricity and gas does not exist in Russia to make a profit. It exists to provide people with electricity and gas. The same cannot be said, alas, in Britain.
Right,
electricity and gas is used by the British state to make money. Like public services in Britain are used by the public state to make money.
All right, stay with me, I mean, because I think we're going to get into the whole, then we look at neoliberalism and what has happened in the West because of those policies. So let me get John in on this conversation. John, your take, you heard what Marcus said, that basically this has been something that has been exaggerated because basically there really isn't a crisis. What do you think?
There is a crisis. It's a global crisis. Excuse me, I'll just change position. The light's in the way here. It's a global crisis caused in large part by the surge in demand for fuel post-COVID by economies all over the world. But Brexit has exacerbated that crisis due to the supply chain issues created by Brexit. The just-in-time supply chain system adopted by the UK has broken down because the importation of vital supplies and basic necessities have been interrupted by increased custom controls and bureaucracy. So there is a multiplicity of crises, and the UK has been in the eye of a storm because of COVID, but also because of Brexit and all the problems that it has unleashed.
Okay, and to our viewers, hopefully we will establish that video connection right now. That was, of course, the voice that you could hear of John. Hopefully we'll establish a better connection. I mean, Marcus, you say that basically you had driven through the country and you went to various stores and you did not notice it. So tell me about when we have been seeing long lines at petrol stations. We have been shown shelves that have been half empty, and we've had people actually had interviews in the UK with individuals on the street that are complaining about the current situation. I mean, what do you say to this? Hasn't the country gone from crisis to crisis, or do you not see it that way?
Well, I must first of all clarify something. There is no global energy crisis. Such an argument is completely untenable. For example, There is no energy crisis in France. There is no energy crisis in Germany. There is no energy crisis in Italy. Indeed, there is no energy crisis anywhere in Europe. Why? Because Europe or the European Union and also individual countries which make up Europe have secured concrete agreements with Russia to receive an uninterrupted flow of gas. Those governments put their people first by wanting to ensure that their industries and domestic households would not be left without electricity or gas at any time of the year. Now, returning to the UK, yes, it is certainly the case that for a few days there was a shortage, and I have to use the word shortage in a very loose way, a shortage of petrol and diesel, not because there was a lack of petrol or diesel in the UK. It was because British mainstream media was putting out stories, as I said moments ago, completely unsubstantiated stories, which caused panic. And as a result, people were stockpiling petrol and diesel. People were going to their local petrol stations. They were taking jerry cans with them. They were filling them up. And that was causing a short-term problem. But that only lasted for a few days. Furthermore, it is the case that in some areas of the UK, supermarkets were not bare. They were not empty, but there were certainly products which were not available. But that was only a few cases. However, British mainstream media has depicted a completely false picture by saying that the whole of the UK is experiencing a shortage of energy and a shortage of food. That is simply not the case. And I believe that part of the reason for this false portrayal is to distract the British people from some very worrying developments at home. And I'm specifically referring to these changes which the British state is imposing on the British people vis-a-vis what is known as COVID-19. But there are also many other problems in Britain. For example, there are 14 million people in Britain living in poverty. That includes 4 million children. 4 million children living below the breadline. Now, one of the tactics the British state has used over centuries to remain entrenched in power is to distract the average British man and woman from what is happening in their society.
Okay.
So, for instance, they will say that Russia is causing the energy crisis. They will say that Russia is a threat to the freedom and democracy of Britain, because they are distracting the British people from the terrible measures and the terrible problems which are plaguing the British people.
Okay, stay with me, Marcus. Let me get John back in on this. John, your take, you were shaking your head partially while Marcus was speaking. Your take on this, so go ahead.
This is not a crisis that's being fabricated by the British mainstream media. There is a material crisis. It's largely a result of the post-COVID demand for energy around the world, especially on the part of the Chinese and Indian economies. European countries are suffering fuel shortages, but not to the same extent as the UK because of Brexit, and also because they have larger and better storage facilities. For example, under the May government, the largest storage facility in the UK that could hold the gas reserves, the fuel reserves, for up to 3 months was shut down by Centrica, and now we only have the capacity to store fuel for another 3 days. So that's had a material effect on the crisis. Gazprom is refusing to, or certainly up to now, has refused to go beyond the contract that agreed with the UK and other European territories for its supply. Putin recently voiced his opinion on the matter, saying that he will not let this crisis go to a certain point. He will look to increase production under Gazprom, which is a Russian state-owned energy giant. But there is a crisis globally because of the demand. COVID has accentuated that crisis. We have a crisis of haulage because of the shortage of HGV drivers, which is also part of the crisis because European drivers can't get into the UK as easily as they did under the EU. Northern Ireland is not suffering the same crisis because it still operates under the single market as part of the Northern Ireland protocol. So I do respectfully, I have to disagree with the first of Marcus's points on this matter.
Well, John, you feel that what you're calling these various crises, that it has been exacerbated by Brexit? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. We have different customs arrangements with the EU. We're not part of the single market. We do no longer have frictionless trade. Boris Johnson lied when he said that his deal, his unready deal, would still maintain frictionless trade. And so it's caused interruption in supply chains, and that has fed into a crisis. So as I said, there's a multiplicity of factors involved, but the issue is that Brexit has only shown dragon's teeth. Rather than free us from the clutches of the dictatorship in Brussels, as its main drivers would have maintained, Nigel Farage and the right wing of the Tory party, it has only made Britain isolated, and it just confirms that Brexit is an entirely misplaced understanding of Britain's role in the world in the second decade of the 21st century. It is an emotional reach back in time to a supposed golden age when Britannia ruled the waves and the Union Jack threw whatever it damn well pleased. And guess what? You can't eat a flag. A flag doesn't eat a hole. It doesn't put food on the table. And this is a result of false consciousness.
Marcus, your thoughts on that? I mean, do you feel that the Brexit has played a role in all of this? Or do you feel that all of this is part of what you said, basically just trying to deflect some other problems, more serious problems that have taken place there?
Well, as I said moments ago, Britain has relied on liquefied natural gas, and Britain should have looked to Germany as an example of ensuring gas, an uninterrupted flow of gas for British industry and households by securing an agreement with Russia. And in the last few days, we have seen a most bizarre chapter with British mainstream media. Because first of all, British mainstream media outlets were running stories saying that Vladimir Putin to increase the supply of natural gas to Europe to avert a crisis. Then within 48 hours or so, the same media outlet was saying that Vladimir Putin is going to decrease the amount of natural gas to Europe to instigate a crisis. It really is preposterous nonsense. I also do not believe in any role in this. I believe that whilst I support Britain withdrawing from the European Union, the European Union is not a socialist entity. It is a neoliberal, culture-hating, religion-hating. It's inflicted horrific damage on the lives of working class people across the European Union. One need only visit countries in Central Europe, such as Hungary and the Czech Republic, and in Eastern Europe, such as Romania and Poland, to see how factories have been as a result of the European Union. But it is most certainly the case, and I've been saying this for many years, that Britain is a country plagued by many illnesses, and this has been the case for centuries. Why? Because the British state, different to the lives of the ordinary British man and woman, wherever they are in the Union, in England, in Scotland, in Wales, in Northern Ireland, they simply do not care. And when I say the British state, I mean the British establishment, for example, the royal family and the aristocracy. For instance, energy should not have been privatised. Electricity and gas should exist to ensure that people do not go cold in the autumn and winter months. Electricity should exist to provide people with lighting at any time of the year. But because the British state values money above all else, it privatised energy. And it is absolutely true that for decades now, not just since Brexit, for decades now, British people in the autumn and winter months have been fearful of putting on the heating because they are afraid they will not be able to pay their energy bills.
All right, let me get John in here because our time is running out quickly. But John, how is it that London still considers itself as Great Britain when it appears that it is getting more and more difficult for it to even keep millions of its people from simply freezing to death? I mean, it really does not sound like a first world country. Your thoughts?
Well, the British political establishment no longer runs an empire, but does operate under the illusions of an empire mind, and this is fed into Brexit. It has also managed to persuade a large swathe of working class people that the Union Jack is the way forward rather than class-based politics, which Marcus has eloquently laid out. I do entirely agree with that large part of the problem is not supply, it's ownership. The energy should be under state control. It's a necessity, it's a basic necessity. Privatisation has been an unmitigated disaster. But the entire Western world is going through the same crisis of late capitalism. But the British state's answer to that crisis, which 2008 global economic crash, has been to withdraw from the world, withdraw from reality, and lose itself in illusions of grandeur based on a misplaced understanding of the British Empire, a failure to address the real history of that empire. So this is a problem of a lack of understanding of Britain's role in the world, the lack of understanding of the empire, of the British obscurantism fed by myths surrounding the Second World War and Britain's role in the Second World War, and the demonization of Russia.
Okay.
Russia is the biggest country in Europe, and the idea that you can isolate Russia, that you can have a Europe that's going to be stable without Russia being included as a major partner.
And on that note, I'm so sorry I have to interrupt. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me on the Spotlight. Marcus Papadopoulos, author and historian out of London. John White, writer and political analyst out of Edinburgh. As always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Razia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum, welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah,
merciful, be especially merciful. My Lord, then do not place me among the wrongdoing people. And indeed, we are able to show you what we have promised them.
So we were talking about the 94th verse of this chapter. رَبِّي فَلَا تَجْعَلْنِي فِي الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ. My Lord, then set me not among the unjust people. And in this program, we'll also talk about the next. وَإِنَّا عَلَىٰ أَن نُرِيَكَ مَا نَعِدُهُمْ لَقَادِرُونَ. And verily, we are able to show you that which we promised them. So these couple of verses are addressed to the Holy Prophet ﷺ, but they are following the same objective as the previous verses, which was threatening the unbelievers, the unjust, and the polytheists with the divine punishment about to come. And of course, this that the Prophet says, رَبِّ فَلَا تَجْعَلْنِي فِي الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ, could be approached from different aspects. But there is no doubt that the conduct of the Prophet ﷺ could not make him the subject to the divine chastisement. And of course, this could be that by this prayer of the Holy Prophet ﷺ, the Almighty Allah is intending to warn the unbelievers that the issue is so serious that by divine command, the great Prophet of Islam himself sought the protection of Allah from the consequences of their beliefs and actions. And secondly, it could be a lesson for the followers of this Prophet that they are not safe from the Almighty Allah's chastisement, and they must always seek His protection regardless of whatever state they might be in. And they must not suppose that they are secluded from the punishments of the Almighty Allah. But what kind of punishment is that? This is the question that this verse might be somehow raising the question, because the Holy Prophet asked the Almighty Allah, رَبِّ إِمَّا تُرِيَنِّي مَا يُعَدُونَ, if you show me what chastisement they are promised. Most interpreters believe that it refers to the worldly punishments that Almighty Allah had inflicted upon the polytheists, including the disastrous and severe defeat they had in the Battle of Badr. But there are other interpreters, however, that think that this verse probably includes the punishment both in this world and hereafter.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Oh.
insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
By considering the fact that this chapter, this surah, was revealed in Mecca, when the believers were forced to undergo many hardships, these verses really gave them solace and comfort. The next verse emphasizes the fact that Almighty Allah is the one who removes any doubt, and by His will we will see the victory of the believers over their enemies, and this verse is actually giving them comfort. The verse says, وَإِنَّا عَلَىٰ أَن نُرِيَكَ مَا نَعِدُهُمْ لَقَادِرُونَ. And verily, we are able to show you that which we promised them. As history has ever shown, this power of Allah has been demonstrated over and over in different places, on different occasions. Of course, after the Battle of Badr, we have seen many of these instances where a much smaller military force inflicted a major defeat upon a much larger and well-equipped enemy by His command and by His will. Almighty Allah gave His Prophet comfort and solace by saying that He had the power to punish the unbelievers, but He often postpones their punishment for various reasons, some of which might be that they are given time and opportunity to repent, or maybe for the sake of a final argument, their punishment is postponed. Or maybe for the reason that in their future generations, some believers are going to be born, so the fathers might be secluded from the chastisement of the Almighty Allah. Or for the sake of the Prophet ﷺ, who is the cause of the blessings and grace. So there are many reasons why the chastisements of the Almighty Allah are inflicted, or why the chastisements and punishments are postponed. We are done with these couple of verses, dear listeners. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. Your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, an Iran sat, or Bat 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavet Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Sanglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Karim Abu Salim crossing, the only crossing into the Gaza Strip for import and export, is under the control of Israel. It keeps imposing restrictions on movement and trade process. The Israeli closure of Karim Abu Salim threatens the economic sector of the Gaza Strip. These threats come in light of the catastrophic economic and humanitarian conditions that the residents of the Gaza Strip have been experiencing for more than 15 years of siege and closure.
About 90% of the Palestinian economy depends on the agricultural sector that is going through many disasters these days, including the continuous wars on Gaza, especially the 2021 escalation. Repeated closures of Karim Abu Salem crossing has negatively affected all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip.
To voice their anger at Israeli restrictions, Palestinian farmers and traders gathered at Karim Abu Salem crossing, the only way for their crops to be sold in markets abroad.
We have lost our money in vain due to the Israeli restrictions. Israel is pursuing a policy aimed at destroying our economy and making us isolated from the world. We demand an urgent help to export our crops to the West Bank and abroad.
Palestinian farmers and traders also expressed the crossing closure as an aggressive act that reflects Israeli insistence on besieging 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
By depriving us of exporting our crops, Israel intends to create chaos in our life. This has already affected our economy and made our life harder. I don't see any promising future for my family.
In light of the Israeli closure of the only crossing in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian farmers and traders who depend on exporting crops for a living are calling on the international community to make action and stop these restrictions that caused serious financial losses. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Thousands took to the streets of Brussels on Sunday to try and apply pressure on heads of governments in the EU to be more decisive when it comes to climate change. It was the biggest protest of its kind since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the 27-nation bloc.
There's a sense of urgency between young people, between elderly people. We are the grandparents for the climate.
There is no plan B, man. Actually, it's just, this moment. This is the moment to change our habits.
You are young and you change the world, and I'm here for change the world.
Droughts, fires, tornadoes, and floods hit regions around the world during the summer, and scientists say fuel emissions are to blame. There was plenty of criticism handed out to EU leaders during the Brussels event.
Our politicians are don't seem to be hearing what we say.
Since the first marches, the political language has changed a bit, but not enough at all.
All these people in the street are necessary to tell politicians
be ambitious because we're going to vote for you.
They're waiting too long. We have to agree with a lot of different countries.
Campaigners warn there will not be many more next generations if greater impetus is not applied to dealing with the crisis, particularly from big carbon emitters like the US, EU and China.
We have to work together, Europe and the whole world.
We should have been here more people to show that we all want change.
With my friends, we're studying in science. We want to fight and change the consequences of the past.
Referring to oil and gas, they chanted, "Keep it in the ground." Doing so might be unjustifiable in the context of economic growth and social inclusion, many analysts argue.
That's because for decades, the richest countries have become richer through the use of fossil fuels. Now developing nations are being told not to do the same by world powers. These poorer countries are saying, fair enough, but you must compensate us financially.
World leaders are being urged to tackle this very issue head on when they meet at the end of the month for a 12-day UN climate change summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Following the Americans' failure in Afghanistan, now the Taliban are rolling over Kabul and other cities and provinces across the nation. New messages painted on the walls in the city center are a reminder of visible changes. Our nation has, with the help of God, defeated America. One of the new Taliban slogans reads, replacing the previous colorful painting. The Afghan flag has largely been replaced with the white Islamic Emirate emblem, with many selling the new banners amid heavy traffic across the city.
After the Taliban takeover, I started selling the Taliban's flags and slogans. It is a good business for me. Many Taliban soldiers and their followers buy and display them on the cars, motorbikes, and houses. I make good money, and it is getting better day by day.
Another challenging change, the level of poverty is rising. Women are selling their gold to get some cash to support their families. Many have lost their jobs, with some struggling to make food for their family. Others are selling household items to make ends meet.
I've brought my household items for sale because there are no jobs. What should we do for a living? I asked the Taliban to create jobs. They must prepare the ground for us to work. Today we are selling household items. What should we do tomorrow?
The most obvious change is the presence of Taliban members themselves. The Taliban are seen roaming the city, guns flung over their shoulders. Some are wearing uniforms and some are in local clothes. And another change, many women are seen to be staying off the streets, but some are seen in longer coats and headscarves, and some in the all-covering burqa. Fewer men are seen wearing Western dress as they have switched to local clothes.
The Taliban takeover changed the face of capital Kabul in many ways. The nation's already flagging economy is collapsing, and creeping chaos is in the making. It remains to be seen what future holds for the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
London is now hosting the biggest and most expensive Islamic exhibit, which focuses its entire attention to the life and legacy of the cousin and son-in-law of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad. The Imam Ali exhibit takes viewers on an interactive journey through the life of Ali ibn Abi Talib, whose loyal service helped create a lasting and perfect religion. Imam Ali is beloved by all Muslims across the globe. For Sunnis, he's revered as the fourth rightly guided Khalifa, but for Shias, he's the first holy Imam. This exhibit offers an exciting and unique opportunity for the community to reconnect with one of Islam's most important historical figures, but also for viewers to learn more information about the life of this character, including things which may have been forgotten historically. Run by the Legacy Group, the creators told Press TV they hoped retracing the life of Imam Ali in full will leave visitors with a renewed connection to this Islamic legend.
So we believe that, that Ali ibn Abi Talib is one of the most amazing characters in history. He appeals to a wide audience. He famously said that he's a person of either your brother in faith or your equal in humanity. His letter to Malik al-Ashtar, which was his governor in Cairo, was referenced by the United Nations as being a reference point for the Arab leaders of the world because he was so adamant on justice on social equality, on fair governance, on non-corruption. And his life as a leader in 4.5 years epitomized and personified that. So our appeal is to share this information with a global audience to come and visit and to see this place.
The exhibit is clearly a roaring success, with hundreds visiting each opening day. Organizers say that expansion plans are in motion and they intend to remain open for the foreseeable future, meaning that Imam Ali's legacy continues to inspire even outside of traditional Muslim homelands. Robert Carter, London.
Yemenis have held an event in front of the As-Salah Al-Kubra Community Hall in Yemen's capital Sana'a to commemorate the fifth anniversary of a massacre committed by the Saudi-led coalition in 2016. Participants condemned the international silence toward this brutal crime, saying when it comes to Yemen, the West continues to show its double standards. Abdusalam Amir is one of those who were present during the attack, where he got injured.
On that day, the sheikhs of the Nahim tribe and I attended to offer condolences to the Al-Ruwaishan family because of our relationship with them. I was sitting there when the unexpected happened, a terrorist crime that killed and injured more than 700 of the best men of Yemen. This criminal act does not differ from the terrorist operations carried out by the coalition of aggression in all cities of Yemen over the past years, and the source of all these crimes is the extremist Wahhabi ideology led by the House of Saud.
On October 8, 2016, Saudi warplanes targeted the As-Salah Al-Kubra Community Hall in Sana'a with at least two airdropped munitions during a funeral ceremony. Over 140 people were killed and more than 600 others were injured in the attack, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
People here say the bombing of the funeral ceremony at the As-Salah Al-Kubra Community Hall revealed the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition against Yemenis. They say Riyadh's crimes will never be forgotten and Saudi Arabia should be brought to justice for its crimes. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in the Syrian capital Damascus and met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. They discussed the military condition in Syrian soil. President Assad stressed that work will continue until liberating all Syrian territories from terrorism and ending foreign illegal presence. Talks also covered regional and international developments, including the situation in Afghanistan. Amir Abdullahian briefed President Assad on the Iranian nuclear file negotiations, expressing Iran's goal to achieve sustainable development. He said Iran wants to cooperate with its neighbors to break the economic siege on his country and neutralize sanctions imposed on the Iranians. Amir Abdullahian also underlined the importance of boosting economic cooperation with Syria.
In the past weeks, we reached important agreements for a full development of relations between both countries in all fields, as well as setting programs for implementing such cooperation agreements in economic, trade, and tourism sectors.
Amir Abdullahian also discussed with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Mahdad recent developments, including the results of his talks with Lebanese and Russian officials related to the Syrian crisis. Mahdad expressed Syria's full support to Iran in its nuclear file.
Syria fully supports Iran in its efforts in the nuclear issue. We strongly condemn the U.S. moves aimed at manipulating Iran's nuclear program and other regional affairs.
This is the second visit for the top Iranian official to Syria in less than 2 months. His trip is part of an international and regional tour which started in Russia. Abdullahian's visit sends a clear message to the enemies of the resistance alliance that decades-long ties between the two countries are constantly developing despite Western and Israeli pressures on both states. It's clear that the two countries maintain the same stance that resistance is the only path to victory in the face of their mutual enemies. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
An official France-Africa summit was organized by French President Macron in the southern French city Montpellier. He had invited state-linked members of the civil society and entrepreneurs. But even there, official participants criticized the colonial and paternalistic attitude of France in Africa. Later at the protest march and the counter-summit, held at the same time and in the same city, African analysts and human rights watchdogs said that France continues to exploit African countries, transferring uranium and other natural resources to Europe.
La position de l'État.
The position of France concerning authoritarian and dictatorial regimes has not changed. This was obvious when Macron went to Chad to support the son of former dictator Déby. France is maintaining its policy of political and military interference to defend its economic interests. France has not changed in this respect.
Political analyst Aziz Fall from Burkina Faso said that France is losing ground in Africa and is therefore using new tactics to seduce the civil society.
Well, basically, the French power is losing its grip in the region, and this is a major change compared to the so-called Cold War era. We have seen Russian, we have seen Chinese coming to the fierce competition, and we are witnessing a new scramble. The Americans are here, so the French need to review the way they will access to wealth in the country, and this is supposed to get rid of the support they have offered to these sellout leaders that are still leading our country.
Migrants formed a dynamic part of the protest march, demanding the end of evictions and official documents for everybody. Thousands died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. Those who succeeded this dangerous adventure became undocumented workers in Europe and faced the risk to be sent back every day.
Yesterday, Macron spoke to the African and French youth about culture, sports and entrepreneurship. My question to him would have been, how can we be partner with France or Europe, given their policy which cost the life of 2,000 young Africans in the Mediterranean Sea only during the last 8 months?
President Macron says he wants to change the relations between France and African countries, but the pretty words at the official summit do not hide the facts on the ground.
Undocumented workers have been arrested upon arriving here in Montpellier and received orders to leave the territory. Macron, with his anti-migrant policy, continues fishing in the waters of the racist far right, and that's a dangerous game. Chris Denant, Montpellier.
Campaigners outside the Liverpool City Council, opposing an upcoming arms fair in their city, home to people of Yemeni and Palestinian heritage.
We are a safe haven and we are a safe place for refugees and people fleeing war. So why are we, on the one hand, being a refuge and on the other hand, selling the weapons that are causing the destruction to life and land and liberty?
The arms fair is set to kick off here in a few days, showcasing plane and missile components, drones and other military hardware. The building is owned by the city council, that campaigners say has refused to cancel the fair despite months of protests and petitions.
I think we have a very right-wing council. They have a mask, they wear a mask, and they try to face both ways. They call themselves socialists, but they implement cuts to vulnerable people. They don't oppose the Tory cuts at all, and more shockingly than anything, they have said they are powerless to stop the arms fair.
Starting on October 12th, the fair will provide a venue for some of the world's most notorious weapons makers, the UK's BAE Systems, which has made a bomb selling arms to Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis to be used against Yemenis. Elbit Systems, a UK-based Israeli company accused of testing its deadly armaments on Palestinians. And American firm Raytheon, also a major supplier to Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
For the last 20 years, Britain has participated in a series of absolutely catastrophic wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, that have caused murder and mayhem around a huge arc of the world. And we really need that to change. And unfortunately, at the moment, our leaders are refusing to learn any lessons from those disasters.
Today's protest follows days of similar action against one of the world's largest arms fairs held in London just last month. And they're all calling for an end to arms exhibits in the UK and the government's unquestioning support for arms exports. Saeed Fariza, Liverpool.
Divestment Sanctions Movement, also known as BDS, has called for a boycott of the ongoing Dubai Expo, BDS is a transnational Palestinian-led organization that works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressures Tel Aviv to comply with international law. The delayed Dubai Expo 2020 kicked off on October the 1st and will be held over the course of 6 months. It is the first time that such an initiative is taking place in the UAE. According to BDS, both the UAE and Israel are shamelessly using the World Expo to whitewash and distract attention from